Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tea Party activists are going to be busy in Washington this weekend with a rally and a convention aimed at taking America back from politicians they say are too liberal. On Saturday, to mark the 47th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, conservative media host Glenn Beck will gather his supporters at the Lincoln Memorial to pay tribute to U.S. troops and also, as he said on his radio program, to reclaim American values and the civil rights movement.
We're going to be there restoring honor in Washington. As we create history together, your children will be able to say, I remember, I was there. As we pick up Martin Luther King's dream that has been distorted.
Tea Party activists will also be attending a convention sponsored by FreedomWorks, the political action group originally bankrolled by the rich libertarian Koch brothers. For months, FreedomWorks has been holding boot camps, teaching Tea Partiers how to win support vote by vote. New York Times reporter Kate Zernike writes about it in today's paper and also in her new book about the Tea Party, Boiling Mad. And Kate, you went to a boot camp earlier this month in Washington. Who attends these events, and what are they learning about going door-to-door for a candidate?
These are Tea Party leaders from across the country who got into politics about a year and a half ago when these Tea Party rallies first started happening, and they were reacting to, you know, against the stimulus bill and the auto bailouts and things like that. And they learn really basic things like take dog treats with you because you want the dogs at the houses to like you, and make sure you write thank you notes and things like that. So it's really basic on the ground, get out the vote training.
And you write that FreedomWorks was the first top-down political action group to really link up with this grassroots Tea Party movement. How did they do that?
The Tea Party movement started with Rick Santelli on CNBC doing this rant calling for a Chicago Tea Party. And literally within hours of that, they had put up a website giving people tips on how to hold tea parties. And then they put up a Google map showing where Tea Party events were. And so people would email FreedomWorks and say, hey, I'm having a tea party too. And this allowed them to sort of know who throughout the country was doing what. And they were just very assiduous about cultivating these different Tea Party groups around the country. And then when they would have sort of a critical mass of maybe 30 in one area, they would get them all together and do one of these training sessions.
And you write the day-to-day work is done by a small core of 20 and 30-somethings, led by a guy named Brendan Steinhauser, and he travels the country giving these boot camps. And you write that he urges activists to work for Republican candidates. But in Maine, Steinhauser also urged activists to organize a challenge to moderate Republican Olympia Snow. So are they with the Republican Party or not?
Well, they are when it's convenient for them. I mean, I think they want to take back Congress just like the Republicans do. But ultimately, their goal is to elect more fiscal conservatives, more libertarians. And people like Susan Collins and Olympia Snow drive them crazy, drive the Tea Partiers crazy. They think they make too many compromises across the line. And they want to see people like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio, who to them are true conservatives, and in particular, economic conservatives. This is not really about social conservatism as we've known it for the last, you know, several decades.
On FreedomWorks' homepage, there's a prominent link to conservative media host Glenn Beck. They share activist kits and how to get involved. He actively promotes FreedomWorks. They're very closely linked to him. What exactly is their relationship?
Well, I think in the beginning there was some suspicion there or some thought that they didn't want to work with others, but Glenn Beck is the biggest celebrity of the Tea Party movement, really more than someone like Sarah Palin, who's often called that. And so they recognize that if they want to build a grassroots, they've got to be partners with Glenn Beck. And they're doing their own rally on September 12th, but I think everyone recognizes that this rally, which is being called the 828 rally, is really going to be sort of what Beck is calling the Woodstock moment, if there is one for the Tea Party this summer. This is where all the activity is going to be, and FreedomWorks wants to be part of that.
Today's Washington Post reports that virtually every Republican operative in Washington claims little or no knowledge of this Beck rally, and it seems that Beck's rally might expose the strengths or the weaknesses of the Tea Party movement. What are your thoughts?
The Republicans don't quite know what to make of the Tea Party movement. The Republicans want the energy of the Tea Party movement, but they do not want sort of the crazy things that we've heard associated with it. You know, they want to kill Social Security. They have all these racist thoughts. They're trying to sort of capitalize on it, but not get too close in the chance that it might also burn them.
Where does Sarah Palin fit in all this?
Sarah Palin is speaking at Glenn Beck's rally, but Sarah Palin has made quite a number of endorsements around the country where local Tea Party groups have not gotten behind her, and they don't agree with her, and they say, we really like her, but we're going to make up our own minds.
Kate Zernike is a reporter for The New York Times and author of Boiling Mad, a new book about the Tea Party. Thank you.
Thank you.
Government statistics out today show new claims for unemployment benefits dropped a bit in the last week, but the overall picture of a week is of a weak job market, with employers reluctant to hire as economic growth slows. Our guest, sociologist Catherine Newman, says this recession will have long-lasting consequences for working Americans, especially for those in middle and lower income groups. And the U.S. is not the only country facing labor issues. Newman is just back from China and says China is losing some manufacturing business to places like Vietnam and Bangladesh, which offer lower wages, as Chinese workers have begun to agitate for higher wages and better working conditions. Catherine Newman is the incoming Dean of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. She joins us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. And Dean Newman, before we turn to Asia, let's talk about the U.S. You call this the unequal opportunity recession. What do you mean by that?
This recession has actually slammed workers across the educational spectrum, but those that are in most trouble are the folks at the very bottom with low skills, less education, minorities, young people. The most powerful and damaging effects are being felt by young Black men who are now experiencing unemployment rates around 50%, which is truly catastrophic for many reasons. It makes them less desirable as marriage partners, and that has effects on family formation. I think manual workers, blue-collar workers, those without a lot of education in general are suffering in this economy.
And you say that the effects may be long-term. You write in The Nation that for young people, quote, their lives will likely be scarred in important, negative ways for years to come. And that comes from studying previous recessions?
Yes, we have data that goes way back to the Great Depression. We have data from the early 1980s, which was the last time that we had double-digit unemployment. And as long as 10 to 15 years after the end of that recession, we still see profound wage effects on workers who entered the labor market during very bad times. So entering a labor market that is very depressed puts pressure on people who are at the bottom of this queue of what employers regard as desirable. And if they stumble for too long, if it takes too long for them to find a place, they can find that even when the economy recovers, they have an aberrant biography. And when employers have a lot of choices, which they do as the economy begins to recover, they may overlook these people. And for years to come, they may suffer the scarring effects of entering a bad labor market and in some instances may never catch up. That's what all the research tells us.
You say underemployment is almost as serious as joblessness. Why?
Well, people who take jobs for which they are overqualified find that they can't escape a kind of trap they've fallen into. On the whole, underemployment means you have a job, but it's not the kind of job for which you're qualified or the kind of job which you were seeking. It means you've settled for less, which is very understandable in a rough economy like this one. But if that persists for a long time, you may find your choices are limited thereafter.
You also bring up what most Americans know by experience, that with a large surplus of unemployed people, there's no pressure to increase wages. Is that what you're finding in this recession as well?
Well, yes, we're seeing wage declines, and we're also seeing that employers are able to exact increasing productivity out of the workers who are still on the job. And that is one of the most important reasons, I think, why we don't see recovery in the labor market, even when orders start to pick up and employers start to see the end of their inventories. They're attempting to get as much labor out of the workers who are already on the payroll before they hire anybody else that's new.
Normally, what people do in a recession is go back to school. They come out with a new degree, a reinvention of sorts. Is that happening during this downturn?
People are trying to do that, and it's a very important route to turning over a new leaf. But sadly, the way this recession has unfolded has made that more and more difficult because the states are cutting back on their support of higher education, and that in turn is causing educational institutions to slam their doors tight. So the junior colleges in California are overwhelmed with applicants. The City University of New York junior colleges, which traditionally accepted applications more or less up to the beginning of the school year, stopped months ago because they're flooded with applicants who are trying to do exactly what they should do, gain new skills, look for a way to recast their profile in the labor market and hope that things will improve out there before they have to go job hunting again. So it's one of the greatest tragedies, I think, of the Great Recession that the major and logical route to reemployment is closing on so many people.
You've also been looking into unexpected effects of what you call this downward pressure, like how the level of qualification you need to get a job in a field goes up when there's a crunch like this.
Once upon a time, I think if we had looked, for example, at the clerical labor force, we would have seen that those were high school graduates able to do a good job with that educational level. Increasingly now, it requires a college degree to be a clerical worker. And that probably came about in part because college-educated workers had other options, but also in previous downturns, you find workers with more education slipping down into downward mobility and then colonizing occupations that didn't used to require those credentials. But once we recover, well, if everybody in the secretarial ranks now has a BA, that's going to become the new benchmark. I don't think we really understand this process as well as we need to, but it's clearly the case that occupations have turned over and required new skills. And it's not easy to tell whether that's because the jobs themselves really do require more skills. For example, it requires more technological knowledge to be a clerical person now. So it's some combination of skill changing and just the options in the labor market mutating in ways that push more skilled workers down into occupations they didn't use to occupy. When I studied the fast food industry in Harlem in the recession period of the mid-90s, it turned out that you needed a high school diploma to get a job flipping burgers in Central Harlem because there was such high unemployment that restaurant owners could demand a high school credential. When that recession went away, they now had a high school educated labor force in front of them. And when they went to pick new people, they were looking for more high school graduates. And so at that point, it becomes a requirement of the job.
Very interesting how that can change over time. The American economy has relied on some basic worker categories for some time now, blue collar, white collar, service. Are those still relevant?
They're relevant to a degree, but the landscape is changing. Now someone who fixes your car needs to know something about computer chips. They didn't need to know anything about computer chips 30 years ago. So the mix of skills that we look for in a manual type job isn't the same anymore, and I'm not sure whether the label still applies in the normal sense of the term. Similarly, we're seeing changes in the gender composition of these jobs. So the nursing labor force is predominantly women, but increasingly men are coming into the nursing labor force as wages rise. So I think the terms are still of some value, but the incumbents in those jobs may look a little bit different in terms of the skills that they bring to the table.
We're speaking with sociologist Catherine Newman about the pressures on workers here in the U.S. When we come back, the pressures in China. And later in the show, call them brownabees, political candidates copying Senator Scott Brown's style on the campaign trail. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to sociologist Catherine Newman about pressures on workers in the U.S. and Asia in a globalized economy. Before the break, we looked at how some Americans entering the labor force now will face years, possibly decades, of lower income because of this recession. But what about workers in Asia? While growth is driving up wages, it's also driving out manufacturers. And Catherine, let's start with China. You were there this summer, and we've been hearing a lot about labor unrest this year. Where were you, and what did you see?
Here's what I saw that I found fascinating. First, it looks incredibly prosperous, even though it's a poor region. In the city of Xi'an, you can go to shopping streets that are teeming like Fifth Avenue with gazillions of young people. And they're wearing the same kinds of designer jeans and probably knockoff handbags that I see among the teenagers in New York City. They are taller. You see their parents who are, you know, my age in their 50s, who are 5 feet 3, 5 feet 4, something like that. And they're children who look just like American teenagers, 5'10", 5'11", 6 feet tall.
But all this commercial activity, and they don't seem to be buying it from us, anything that we're making in the U.S.
Well, that is the sad part. They are definitely buying, but they're buying what we're buying, and we're buying goods made overseas, and they're buying goods made in their home cities and in the factories around them.
At the same time, there's a growing labor movement in China, recently passed a new labor law in June of 2008. And we heard of workers who say, I don't know what this law is, but I do know that it's pro-workers. So it's an energized worker movement. Did you see signs of that? And what does it mean for China's economy?
Well, what we see in China, as you said, are growing labor strikes, which are quite unusual. But workers are looking to capitalize on the growing productivity and wealth in China and to claim their share. And this is made more likely by the fact that the one-child policy in China reduced the size of the generation that is in the labor force right now. Who would ever have thought that China would have a labor shortage? It's an ironic aspect of the one-child policy, which was built to try and feed the population and to reduce poverty in China, that instead it's creating increased wage demands, which is sending manufacturers in China out of the country. And so I also visited Vietnam and India this summer, and all over South Asia, especially including regions like Bangladesh, you see the outflow of Chinese demands for productivity out in the countryside of those countries.
You know, we're reading about some of this and the advantages to companies, factories, when they move out of China to a place like Bangladesh, where workers earn about $64 a month, while the minimum wage in China's coastal industrial province is about twice that. But workers in Bangladesh are less educated and less productive. What does that mean for their economies?
Well, it means a huge shot in the arm for the economy of Bangladesh and a big shot as well for the rural villages around cities like Bangalore in India. So Bangalore, which was the sort of capital of U.S. outsourcing, to which we sent a lot of our call centers and other kinds of back office functions, in the regions around Bangalore where people speak just enough English to be able to do the lowest level of those sorts of jobs, it's meant a surging economy, it's meant rising wages, and it's meant rising unemployment in Bangalore. So even in countries like India, which we think of as sort of a threat to the American worker, within the country, they too are facing threats in cities like Bangalore as the labor migrates to cheaper regions in India. So our best bet lies in educating our workforce and competing at the high end, which, by the way, is also increasingly under threat. We are starting to see law firms setting up overseas and engineering firms setting up overseas because they can hire very well-educated and skilled labor for a fraction of the price that you would pay an American professional. So we face these threats all up and down the spectrum of skill, but we definitely are not going to be able to compete at the very bottom. No American worker is going to be able to exist on 60 cents a day.
So put it all together for us, the U.S. and this recession that's going to have long-term negative impacts, especially for young people, especially for young African-American men, wages going up in China, forcing some manufacturing to go to India and Bangladesh. How does it all come together?
Well, it comes together in a great big ball of problems for us, which is that it's hard to see where the demand is going to come from that will ignite American industry again. We were hoping, all of us, that it would happen in China, it would happen in India, that the growth of the middle class in those countries would start to fuel demand for refrigerators, television sets, the kind of high-end production that we have been known for. But increasingly, those countries have ramped up their own high-end production and are able to satisfy more of the internal demand by themselves. Now, that said, we still have an enormous economy, by far the biggest in the world. And a good deal of our production and consumption is internal to the American labor market. So these changes, which are very worrying, are really more on the margins than most of us realize because we think of this as such a global economy, and of course it is, but we are still heavily an internal market-driven economy. So a lot of our fortune depends on whether we can start putting people back to work so that the demand will rise for what we produce in the United States, both in terms of services and goods. During the Great Depression, we put 4 million people back to work in 3 months. And that's because Roosevelt created the legislation and rammed it through Congress. And lo and behold, we had 4 million people back to work. I do think we've underutilized that tool. It's not popular among many conservatives and those in Congress. But to leave our people out on the sidelines where their skills are rotting, where their opportunities to get back into the labor market long term may be seriously compromised, is definitely the less desirable option.
Catherine Newman is a professor of sociology and the incoming dean of arts and sciences at Johns Hopkins University. She joined us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new film renews the debate over the death of Pat Tillman. He gave up his pro football career to join the Army, and when he was killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan, the military covered it up. We'll speak with Pat's mother, Mary. That's tomorrow. News is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Monica Brady-Myrov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As students squeeze in their last bit of summer, some educators across the country are re-examining the high school years. Several states are introducing programs next year that would allow 10th or 11th graders who pass a series of tests to get their diploma early and move on to college. Proponents say cutting out junior or senior year could fast-track qualified kids onto a career path. New Hampshire is one of the states eyeing this makeover. Paul Leather is Deputy Education Commissioner in the state. And Paul, what motivated New Hampshire to try it out?
Well, we have been working with a gentleman by the name of Mark Tucker of the National Center for Education and the Economy for several years now, and have been examining processes that have been taking place across the world, looking at students having the opportunity to demonstrate their mastery of learning, and based on that demonstration, move on when they're ready to move on to college and careers. Also, we've been looking at trying to reduce the number of New Hampshire high school students who move on to college but still need remediation. So it's really been those two focus areas that have interested us in this project.
Will it also save the state money?
We're not sure that that's the case. We haven't done a full cost analysis. In the short term, probably not, because we would be looking at, one, piloting a system along with our existing system, and then, two, looking to go to scale if it demonstrates that it has validity.
So you're poised to launch this for the 2011-12 school year, but won't kids with one less year of schooling be at a disadvantage?
Not if they've already demonstrated that they are ready for college and ready to go to college without remediation. We are quite hopeful that by demonstrating on a comprehensive examination called a board examination, that students would be able to show that they have the requisite academic and other skills necessary to succeed in college. If they're ready to go on, then they're ready to go on.
Is there demand for this?
Well, what's interesting is that we're starting to see students move on whether they're allowed to go on or not. A new category that we've been showing in our graduation rate here in New Hampshire are the number of students who have essentially decided to enroll in college whether they have graduated or not.
And without a diploma.
That's correct. And the reason that's possible is that many schools are moving away from documenting their students' history and giving them entrance examinations. And if they score well on an entrance examination, then they're able to enroll and demonstrate their ability to succeed in college courses.
So this would allow you to end your high school career at 11th grade with a diploma and move on to college.
That's what this proposal is really about, is creating a methodology by which a student would prove that they've mastered the expected learning in high school And once they've done that, we would hope and expect that their institutions would offer them a diploma. The details of this have not been worked out, of course. This is as proposed, but that's how we're looking at it.
Could it create a tiered system in high schools with some students on a 3-year path, others on a 4-year path, some in honors?
Well, we look at it as really multiple pathways to high school completion. A student might take the examination at the end of their 10th or 11th grade, and if they succeeded at the exam, they could choose to enter an open admissions college or university. They might also then choose to go to an extremely competitive, higher-level high school educational experience, similar to the International Baccalaureate or the Cambridge system. Another option would be if a student is not able to demonstrate that they have met the expectations of the exam, they might continue to take courses building up to their time to be able to pass the exam.
Don't some schools already have opportunities like this for kids to graduate early?
Absolutely. A number of schools, if a student is able to demonstrate that they've either met the credits or met the expectation of the courses, they're able to graduate early and move on.
Paul Leather is Deputy Education Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Education. Thanks so much.
Okay.
It's Here and Now. Is Alaskan Senate candidate Joe Miller pulling a Scott Brown? Miller was way behind in the polls and in cash before Tuesday's Republican primary against Senator Lisa Murkowski. Today, the race is too close to call and will depend on absentee ballots, which are being counted. Miller had the support of Tea Party activists and even campaigned in a pickup truck, just like Scott Brown. There are a string of candidates nationwide who seem to be mimicking the Massachusetts senator's style on the campaign trail. Here and Now media analyst and Boston University communication professor John Carroll joins us with more. Hi, John.
Hi, Monica.
The Boston Globe noticed this trend in New Hampshire in the Republican primary. What's going on there?
There's four Brownabies up there in a single race. It's really interesting. They're running to fill the seat of Judd Gregg, and it's the GOP primary, and all of them are adopting some form or some trapping or another of the Scott Brown campaign. One's wearing a barn jacket, one's driving a pickup with a snowplow to one-up Scott Brown.
In the dead of August?
In the dead of August, right. It's mostly for show. I'm sure it'll come in handy at some point. And one of them has one of his strategist. Somebody else has Ayla Brown, Scott Brown's daughter, up there campaigning for them. So this is an attempt to sort of catch on to what they see as this sort of playbook that Scott Brown used to win his seat in the people's seat. Sorry, it's not his seat, it's the people's seat here in Massachusetts.
What about Republican Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri? What inspiration does it seem like he's gotten from East Coast Scott Brown?
Well, he's driving a rented pickup truck and wearing a plaid shirt, although the plaid shirt is his, my understanding is. But they asked him, you know, what's with a rented pickup truck? And he says, well, nobody uses their personal vehicle. He drives a black SUV around Washington, D.C. This is all about trying to create an image for people, an image that they may associate with Scott Brown. But pickup trucks go back. People have been using them. Fred Thompson used them in the 90s to win his seat in Tennessee. Lamar Alexander was wearing a plaid shirt and walking across Tennessee in 1978. So this isn't anything particularly new. They're grabbing on to the trappings and the easiest parts of what Scott Brown did. What Scott Brown did was really hard, and the other elements of his win are things that really can't be duplicated.
Yeah, and it doesn't always work. I mean, John Kerry wore a barn jacket while campaigning for president, and that didn't turn out so well for him.
Yeah, he also wore a lot of spandex when he was windsurfing. That didn't help.
Well, what about here in Massachusetts? Democrat turned independent candidate Tim Cahill is running for governor. Is he trying to get the Scott Brown glow?
Tim Cahill did an interesting thing. His first ad, which was a web ad, actually, was a virtual carbon copy of one of Scott Brown's ads. He was in the kitchen. He had his Father Knows Best sweater on. And he was talking about how he's being attacked.
Now Charlie Baker and his Washington friends are desperate to tear me down with over $1 million of negative attack ads.
This was a strategy of Scott Brown's to sort of play rope-a-dope when people were attacking him during the campaign. And it generated a fair amount of sympathy among people, among the voters. So Tim Cahill is looking at this and saying, maybe if I do the sort of the Gandhi thing that that Scott Brown did, maybe that'll work for me too, and it'll look like I'm being victimized by people playing dirty politics.
Then there's the race in the U.S. Senate in New York for Kirsten Gillibrand's seat. Republican hopeful Bruce Blakeman has been calling himself the Scott Brown candidate since Brown won the election back in January. How's that race going?
Well, Bruce Blakeman has one thing that Scott Brown had going for him. He's 30 points behind. So I think that he's invoking Scott Brown as the sort of the comeback kid and saying, we can mobilize at the grassroots here. He's got virtually none of the elements that that Scott Brown has. And I think when you look at what Brown did, it was improbable, bordering on miraculous. And there was a confluence of circumstances and elements and events that came together for Scott Brown's race that just aren't going to be there for anybody else's. I mean, is your...
Like what?
It's a dead of winter in Massachusetts. You've got a telegenic candidate with a camera-ready wife and two telegenic daughters. You've got a ham-handed and tenured opponent in Martha Coakley. And you've got this symbolic seat that everybody was calling Ted Kennedy's seat until Scott Brown turned it around and created this image of the people's seat, which was a really powerful image for him.
The talk radio also picked up on.
Absolutely. So all of those things are not reproducible in these other campaigns. So you can adopt the trappings, but the real heart of why Scott Brown won that special election is something that's completely different from barn jackets and pickup trucks.
Well, despite that, even former Massachusetts governor and Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney has jumped on the bandwagon. Tell us about that.
Well, he actually, it's automotive fashion. He drove a pickup truck to a New Hampshire fundraiser and was dressed casually. And Mitt Romney as man of the people really is a stretch. I mean, it really doesn't work all that well. And I think it becomes so transparent after a while and so unnatural that what it does is it starts to backfire on you because it calls attention to your sort of trying to manipulate your image as opposed to creating an image, and people see through that.
Has it backfired in anyone? Let's look at the Arkansas primary race for U.S. Senate there. Bill Halter was narrowly defeated by Blanche Lincoln. What happened in that race?
I don't think it backfired on Bill Halter. I mean, he was doing the whole pickup truck, the whole man of the people thing. I think he was caught up in a real strange dynamic where Bill Clinton came into the state and rescued Blanche Lincoln. And Blanche Lincoln was supposed to lose that primary, and Bill Clinton came in and really help turn that around for her. So I think Halter was as much a victim of circumstances as anything else.
Well, besides the fact that Brown won, what are candidates trying to capture by copying Scott Brown? What is it that barn jacket and pickup truck says?
I mean, what it says is that this sort of populist image, this sort of forthright kind of candidate, somebody who is about the people's business as opposed to about politics as usual. It helps to pick out an issue that Scott Brown focused on health care reform. A number of candidates are doing that this time around as well. There's some jumping on the Homeland Security bandwagon. But what they're looking for is that sort of combination that clicks with the public, that makes you stand out as something special, something out of the ordinary. That's the way Scott Brown came across. And I think it's hard to create that kind of moment. Barack Obama did it. Scott Brown did it. Not every politician can go out there and manufacture that out of thin air.
Do you think it will work for anyone?
I think some of the elements will work. Some of the elements have always worked, that kind of populist appeal, the way of trying to communicate with people, get people to identify with you. I think that works very often. But I think the real specialness of Scott Brown's win and the real sort of improbability of it is something that not a lot of people are going to be able to replicate.
Well, you may have seen Banana Republic has introduced a Mad Men line of clothing. Maybe L.L. Bean should do the same with a line of jackets for political candidates.
Sure, the Scott Brown line. And then Ford could come out with a special custom pickup truck, too.
Here and Now media analyst and Boston University communication professor John Carroll on how the Scott Brown phenomenon is playing out in political races across the country. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Monica.
And by the way, you can follow John's blog, Campaign Outsider, by going to our website, hereandnow.org. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Welcome back.
All alone, hear a voice bouncing echoes in my head. First a thought,
When Jerry and Sandy Cherryholmes decided to form a bluegrass band with four of their children, but without a professional musician in the bunch, they had no idea of what success lay ahead. Their family band, Cherryholmes, tours, performs regularly at the Grand Ole Opry, and in 2005 was named Entertainer of the Year by the International Bluegrass Music Association. This is from their latest CD.
When it's not every day that I don't burst the ground I used to bow down on, and you're finally gone, and it's not with me every day.
That's When It's Not With Me Every Day, from Cherryholmes 4, Common Threads. The six Cherryholmes are Jerry and his wife Sandy and children Sia, BJ, Skip, and Molly. That's Sia singing there, but they switch off singing lead vocals. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Joining us in the studio are mandolin player Sandy Cherryholmes. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much.
And 20-year-old son Skip, who plays the guitar. Welcome to you as well.
How are you doing?
Sandy, this is a story that some of our listeners might be familiar with, but many are not. Your band began out of tragedy. Tell us about it.
Back in 1999, we were all pretty much a normal family living in Los Angeles. There were five of the, children. They're not children now, but children living at home. And our oldest daughter passed away unexpectedly before her 21st birthday. Her name was Shelley. About 6 weeks later, Jerry and I took the four kids that were living at home to a bluegrass festival. We just wanted to get away from everything. And we had such a wonderful time. It was just so much fun that on the way home, Jerry said, you know, we ought to really do with the young ones now is get them some instruments and we'll start a family jam and we'll play this bluegrass music. We didn't have any goals. We didn't care if they could play or they couldn't. We just really felt a need to draw everyone close together and enjoy that experience.
And Sandy, your music has other influences as well. For example, let's listen to a song off your 2005 album, Shelley in the Heather, Linda's Reel. It has more of an Irish feel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we really love the Celtic music. It is part of our, I think, part of our genes, genealogy too, and that seems to come out of us without us even realizing it.
From LA and you're in the bluegrass field. Nobody ever questioned your credentials?
Yeah, they did. We really had to hide them. We tore the plates off our bus about as fast as we could leave the state because that was the thing. We had the three strikes, LA, women, and
family,
little kids.
Little kids. That was bad for bluegrass?
Oh, well, it was bad for professional. It was bad for professional bluegrass. Then as we were accepted, that mystique of being from LA became, you're from LA? Well, everyone's from Nashville. You're from LA. So then we had to turn it around. And then we could start admitting, yeah, we're from Los Angeles.
Well, let's go back to the new album, Common Threads. And as we said, you switch off singing the lead vocals on your songs. For example, Sandy, let's listen to you on Changed in a Moment.
I'd taken the wrong road, way down by my own heavy load. I had to make a change, had to lay it down. Sitting in a church pew, the word stirs my soul in ways I never knew. I got an invitation. What does it all mean? Oh.
I'm going to go to you, Skip, to ask you whether there's any conflict over who sings lead on what. We're listening to your mom here singing lead, but every single one of you takes a turn at it.
Actually, really, from the get-go of more or less putting together a song, we just start out looking at the material we have. Our predominant songwriters would be Sia and BJ. And Sia, she has a really good talent in writing for a specific person. So if she's thinking, well, you know, I have an idea and I think it would really fit BJ, Molly, or myself to do, then she writes targeting that specific person singing the song.
Skip, you sing lead on It's Your Love. Was that written by Sia?
No, it was actually written by BJ. I think Sia helped out on some of the chorus work. And at the time, I hadn't had a song for the record that we were putting together. And he said, well, you know what? Try this one. I actually had just recently engaged to be married. He also is too, which is where he, the inspiration of the song came out of that, but it is also fitting for myself.
Time has made me realize I need your love just to survive. Without you, I would not
Skip, this is probably a hard question to answer with your mother sitting next to you, but working with the family every day, does it get to be a strain?
I won't lie. There are times when everybody bumps heads, and, you know, if you're going to go out on the road for 2 months with six of your family members, it's not always going to be, you know, cream and cookies. You're going to have arguments. You're going to have yelling fests. It gets to you, but I honestly couldn't think of a better group of people to work with because we know each other. Whether it be musically or just in general, just look at each other and know what the other person's thinking because we know each other so well. And that is why I think it makes it so easy to do this with your family.
Yeah, I see two astounding successes here. A family that gets along so well and really a lot of success in the bluegrass music world. Let's listen to another song here, Weaver of Lies.
There's so many things I have done. Dishonest gain from the skill of my tongue. If you're unwise enough to trust me, then you will be deceived. You never should believe. You'll only be deceived.
Where do you see the family going, evolving with this band? How does it change as your lives change? As you say, you're getting married soon, so is your brother. How's that going to change the Cherry Holmes band?
We just take the same concept that we always have taken ever since the very beginning. For now, you know, we're playing music together, we're enjoying it, we're touching lives, and we're having a lot of fun. Who knows, maybe tomorrow someone could have a health problem and it'd be all over, but you know, we're not worried about that right now. We're here for what we're doing.
You know, we started it not unintentionally, and we never knew where it was going to go. Jerry always said, let's take the family on an adventure. We don't know where it'll go. We don't know how long it'll last. And we all feel that way. I think that that's something that we all do agree on, is we just take each year as we take it, make our decisions, and we'll know which way to go when the time comes.
Well, this adventure is great listening for all the rest of us. I really enjoy your music. We've been talking to Sandy and Skip Cherry Holmes, two of the six members of the family band Cherry Holmes. Their latest CD is Cherry Holmes 4 Common Threads. They're also on tour. For more information, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Sandy and Skip, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Our producers include Lynn Menegon, Hitesh Hatti, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Karen Pelland. Our intern is Cassandra Sunt. Jeremy Bernfeld helps us out with the web. Our technical director is Doug Shugarts, assisted today by Jim Kiesling. Chris Ballman is the managing editor, and the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Monica Brady-Myrov. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.